Hello and welcome to this rebroadcast of episode 84 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from Joshua Tree, California. I am Andrew Brokus. I will be joined soon, or 5 years ago, depending on how you want to look at it, by Nate Mavis and Leo Wolpert. So let me tell you a little bit about what's going on here, for those who don't know. There was a period in 2014 when the Thinking Poker Podcast was on a podcast stream offered by Poker News, meaning that we were not on our usual feed, and people who subscribe to the Thinking Poker feed, or if you subscribe to it now, you wouldn't get these episodes. We have the right to these episodes, but they were only ever broadcast on the Poker News feed, and we never put them on the Thinking Poker feed. So a lot of people who have discovered the show in the last 5 years have said, hey, what happened to these episodes, like 82 through 90 or whatever it is? I can't find these episodes, and that's because they didn't exist anywhere. Fortunately, Russ Fox, who is a regular listener to the show, a good friend, he is also my tax guy. I'd recommend him to be your guy, and you can find out more about him at Clayton Financial. But Russ had every episode of the show downloaded and was able to share these lost episodes with us. And as I said, we do still have the rights to them. So we don't have a new episode for you this week. So I figured I would share this episode featuring Leo Wolpert. So Leo, for people who don't know, his first appearance on the podcast was way back on episode 10. That one is available on the Thinking Poker feed if you want to hear the origins of Leo. But Leo's a good friend of the show. I think doesn't play a whole lot of poker these days. He's been doing more legal work, but for a while was a professional poker player, still a very good poker player, someone I enjoy talking poker with. He also shares a background in Quiz Bowl with Nate. This episode, I just want to emphasize to people, was recorded in 2014, so things that we talk about on the episode are not things that are happening at the World Series of Poker in 2019. They are things that were happening in 2014. If there's mention of a Nickcast meetup, obviously that happened 5 years ago, so don't show up at the Rio on, on the day mentioned. I'm going to do my best to take any old ads off of the episode, but it's possible that I'll miss some. So if you hear old advertisements, those are old advertisements, and anything offered in those advertisements are not still available. As for new advertisements, I should tell you that we are still sponsored by Tournament Poker Edge, and this is a great time to join Tournament Poker Edge. I've got a video series that's going up right now, which is me reviewing longtime TPE member Rice Man, reviewing a tournament that he played that I think probably better reflects the stakes that a lot of TPE members are actually playing, as opposed to when I do hand history reviews of tournaments that that I've played. I mean, some people find that entertaining, some people are aspiring to play those stakes, a lot of people aren't currently playing those stakes, and so I think it's will be interesting for people to get my feedback on how you should be playing at smaller stakes. And it's probably not going to be as different as you think it is. So I encourage you to check that out. But speaking of hand history reviews, I'm also actively working right now on getting together a video series that's going to go through my deep run in the 2019 main event of the World Series of Poker. And that will be showing up on Tournament Poker Edge, I think in the next 2 months. I'm not sure exactly the timeline of it. Could be sooner than that, but this would be a good time to join Tournament Poker Edge because you know you're going to want to see that anyway, so you might as well get in there now and check out all the other great stuff that they have. 10 years worth of content. I think you can find something that's going to justify your $25 a month over there. Also would encourage you to check out my book, Play Optimal Poker, if you haven't done so already. Thanks to Nate Silver, who tweeted about it, and also to Jamie Kerstetter, who mentioned it on ESPN. I got a nice little bump in sales from those things, and I'm back on top of the Amazon rating. So this is the number one best-selling poker book on Amazon. And what that means is, even if for some reason you think it's not going to be helpful to you, a lot of your opponents are probably reading it, and you want to know what they're reading and what they're learning. So I would encourage you to pick up Play Optimal Poker. There's a couple ways that you can do that. You can get it from Amazon the way you get any other book from Amazon. It's available there both in Kindle and paper format. If you want an ebook format other than Kindle, you can buy it from the Knitcast store. That's at knitcast.com, NITCAST.com. And if you buy it there, you will get three ebook formats. You will get Kindle, you will get EPUB, and you will get PDF. You can also find on the Knitcast store past premium podcasts, previous books that I've written, previous books that Nate has written. A lot of neat stuff there on the Knitcast store. I encourage you to check that out. All right, I think that's everything. Enjoy this interview from 2014 with Leo Wolpert.
Danger is stealing in as relapse sums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
How's it going?
All right, how are you?
Doing well. We got you, Leo.
What's up? Can you hear me?
Yes.
I hear you. Excellent.
You sound very good.
Fantastic. You do too.
Ah, thanks. I'm surprised I sound good. I'm going through the pre-World Series of Poker strengthening of the immune system. Yeah.
You're strengthening it the old-fashioned way, huh?
Yeah, by getting a nasty cold.
I guess now I can almost hear the congestion.
All right.
It's true. You do need to strengthen your immune system because the Rio flu is real.
Yeah. I've managed to fade that a few times. So,
I've faded it despite being, you know, a disgusting compulsive nail biter. So.
Oh wow.
I must have a godlike immune system.
Yeah, that's
that
like,
must be the only explanation.
That's like elite level fading of the Rio flu. So nice work.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
I'm actually a nail biter myself, but the being in a casino deters me from doing it. I'm that repulsed by the the filthiness of the cards and the casino chips and every other surface in the casino that it's really the only time I can consistently keep my fingers out of my mouth.
Oh, it's true. Like during the World Series of Poker, sometimes I'll get a little bit of a decent looking nail growth that would make me almost consider getting into the hand modeling biz, but it's always like, you know, one bad play and then like one hand washing and then I'm sitting at home and my hands are in my mouth and my nails are like down to nubs.
I mean, that's good because that's precisely the time at which you would consider a career change to hand modeling the most, right? Like after you've busted out and played poorly.
Oh, for sure. It's the time when I consider a career change to anything but poker.
Good. How's the series treating you generally?
Not too shabby. Three caches. Not for any kind of huge amount, but they all came pretty early in the series, so it was nice to get that confidence boost. Yeah. But that's a bit of a mixed blessing because with the confidence boost comes occasionally going for it in spots where maybe you should just not be going for it.
Right. So that's interesting because I think when we talked earlier, you were saying you're proud of yourself for pulling the trigger and going for it in spots where you otherwise might not. Now you think you might be overdoing it.
Well, yeah, you're proud when you cash, and when you don't cash, you feel like an idiot.
Exactly. It's called being results oriented, which is an affliction that I have to admit affects me. But in certain spots and against certain opponents, you should just be going for it relentlessly, and you know, in other spots, especially against kind of unknowns where say a play depends on them, you know, folding a specific hand in their range that might be toward the top of their range, but on an absolute scale is not that good. Say, you know, a top pair type hand with not much kicker. If you don't know whether they're thinking about how far up they are in their range, you might not want to try and pull that off. Or try and attempt to pull off a big bluff. I've almost like pretty much spoiled the hand I was going to tell, but
well, do you want to get into that hand then?
Certainly.
Can we just tell people that this is episode 83 of the Thinking Poker podcast? That we have with us Leo Welpert, who will not be any surprise to longtime listeners of the show, but those of you who are new, Leo's been mostly an MTT pro, although I know I ran into you sometimes at some 5-10 games on Full Tilt back in the day. But absolutely. So you've been some sort of poker pro for how long?
I would say for about, I've been playing poker seriously, I'd say, since about 2005.
So coming up on 10 years.
I graduated college. So that would be about almost a decade.
Impressive. And you're live now in Las Vegas, playing some combination of cash games and tournaments, mostly in that area?
Yes. I would say when they're good tournament series in town, and the World Series of Poker is certainly one of those, I tend to play more tournaments. And when there aren't, and there aren't ones worth traveling to, and I don't really like to travel that far unless I win a package or otherwise have some incentive, such as I'm already going to be in the place that the tournament is at or near that place, then I'm usually not going to travel for a tournament. But so when those times, when those tournaments aren't taking place, I'm usually just in Vegas playing cash games, live cash, like at Bellagio mostly.
And unlike Nate and myself, you've been out there since the start of the series. I know you mentioned you cashed 3 times. Which tournaments did you cash?
I cashed the 1500 shootout for a min cash, which is a good one to min cash because it's almost a full 3x your buy-in. I cashed the 1500 6 max, and I cashed the 3k 6 max, and made the final 5 tables, I guess. Got 29th. I almost instinctively divided by 9 instead of 6, which would be problematic for a 6-handed tournament.
How did you find the field in the 6 max? My general assumption has been that the short-handed tournaments tend to have somewhat tougher fields, and the tournaments with greater than $1,500 buy-ins tend to have somewhat tougher fields.
Let's see. I feel like early on I felt very in control and felt like I wasn't getting put in ridiculously tough spots in both the 1500 and the 3K 6 max. And I think a lot of that just has to do with luck of the table draw. There were some tables I could just look around and see tables where I recognized 3 or 4 faces, and they were faces I did not want to see across from me at the poker table. I think the fields in general have gotten a little tougher, and that really manifests itself as you go deeper in the tournament. When I got deep in the 3K and the 1.5K 6 max, I never really felt like there were any bad players at the table or people making ridiculously obvious mistakes in the, I guess from the tactical sense. I think from the live tell sense, maybe from the live tell sense especially, I think there were still people kind of giving things away and telegraphing their actions in all these tournaments. But from more of a tactical and overall like strategic sense, I feel like people have been getting better and better, and that the edges in MTTs are just getting smaller and smaller.
Well, 6 max tournaments too, I think that better players are... I think it's harder for less good players to do well in a 6 max tournament because they're forced to play more marginal situations, which is where their disadvantage manifests itself the most. So I think it's even more so than in any tournament. I think in a shorthanded tournament, you're more likely to get a concentration of tough players as you get deeper into the tournament. I think it's pretty tough for a player to like catch a heater and go deep the way that they can in a 10-handed tournament, where even like all you have to do is know how to play good starting hands and then get dealt good starting hands and you're in.
That's definitely true. And to a certain extent, people over-adjust in 6 max. I think people will get it in a little bit too light in certain spots. People will really kind of spaz out exactly because of what you said, because there's nowhere to hide, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And you just have to play back at people if you want to survive. And sometimes people take that to the extreme and do it in spots where they're just really not getting what they want, i.e. a fold.
Yeah, I do think it's kind of weird how so many people who are like accustomed to playing 9 or 10 handed tournaments, like act as though a six-handed tournament is just a completely different animal. And like, it's not like you, I mean, anytime three people fold at a nine-handed table, you're basically playing a six-handed tournament. I don't think there are reasons why like the correct play would deviate particularly much from what it would be in that same situation in a 10-handed tournament, but or a 9-handed tournament. But I think a lot of people have this mindset that like you have to be so much more aggressive in a 6-handed tournament. And I mean, to the extent that that's true, they probably should be more aggressive than they are in those situations in 9-handed tournaments.
I agree with you 100%. Though I guess there's bunching, but that...
I'm not a big believer in bunching.
I'm almost a believer in bunching, but I mean, I think the effect it's going to have on only having folded six cards out of the deck in front of you is going to be like negligible and something that you could ignore. Now, maybe the difference between, you know, six cards and 12 cards being folded in front of you, that, and then maybe it might have a little bit more of an effect. But I think probably getting a bit off topic.
I think it's interesting. I mean, Nate is our stats expert. What's your thought on this idea, Nate, that once people have folded, you can assume that the cards other people are holding are going to be somewhat stronger on average?
Yeah, I mean, it's plainly true, right? Because Hold'em is a game in which big cards are better. But I take it to have been shown more or less conclusively that the fact is very, very, very small in the situation you describe when six cards have been folded, just because a lot of cards get folded anyway. And sometimes and the rate at which big cards are folded is smaller, but not that much smaller than the rate at which small cards are folded. So strictly speaking, it's of course an effect that exists, it's just a fact that's been shown with simulations and everything that that is something we are pretty much wasting our time to think about.
Yeah, I really can't think of any situation where it actually affected my decision.
So you're welcome, listeners, for wasting your 2 minutes there.
I mean, I guess it's kind of built into, like, if you look at things like optimal shove ranges from the button or optimal shove ranges from the small blind, would that kind of thing, like, if I just use a tool like Leo actually just introduced me to Hold'em Resource Calculator, if I'm using a tool like that, is that taking bunching into effect? I guess it's not.
I think I actually read on their site, because I actually looked into this exact question, that it does not take bunching into account. That Hold'em Resources Calculator does not do that.
Wait, so Leo's being really like gentle about his belief that we should stop talking about this, but I do want to ask Andrew. I do want to ask Andrew about something he said, where it's
gentle
never,
about
like,
my belief. I'm more like apologetic about bringing it up in the first place.
I'm just saying you're being really polite about it instead of like calling Andrew and me idiots for like wasting everybody's time. You know?
Oh, no, I think you're the ones who should be calling me idiots. But no, sorry to interrupt.
No. But Andrew said that it's never affected his play, and certainly folding is never affected. I mean, you know, the fact that the first five people have folded, I've never thought that the deck must be rich in high cards or something. I mean, in some sense it will be, but I've never used that to condition my play. But have you ever like tried to guess at folded cards? Like, I mean, so let's say somebody raises, then a very particular kind of tight player calls, and then somebody three bets, right? Well, I mean, you can construct different situations like this, but my point is that I think I've sometimes, after, let's say, the first person folds, or let's say I'm the guy in the middle. Sorry, I'm sick. I'm not constructing this hypothetical very well. But there are a lot of people whose call raise and then fold range, or raise then fold range, is really ace heavy, and there can be cases where that ace blocker does mean a lot. Do you ever find yourself thinking like that?
I can't say that I do. I mean, certainly like post-flop, I might consider if I think someone had a certain type of hand, like in a multi-way pot, and ended up folding it. I think there's more room to have that sort of information about their hand. I can't think of too many situations where I feel like I have a pretty good idea that someone, you know, does or doesn't have an ace based on the fact that they raised and then folded to a re-raise, or called and then folded to a re-raise or something.
Yeah, I mean, it happens mostly in live games where there are people whose like cold calling range in certain spots is exactly ace queen and ace jack. So, but I think at least once or twice. And when I say that, of course, it's once every hundreds and hundreds of hours. Right. But I think I have gone with a hand, partly because I thought there was that blocker out, and either that gave me a little more fold equity or gave my equity against the relevant opponent's range a little boost. So it's not quite bunching, but there is room to guess at preflop folded cards sometimes, I think.
Oh, yeah. To the extent that I do it, I think it's as a mechanism to force myself to follow the action and turn it into a little game for myself. Like, yeah. What's the absolute best hand this person could be folding? Not so much to maybe inform my actual decision, but more to just give myself a reason to pay attention to what they're doing. And also, I think it comes up more in live games because of the live tell aspect. For instance, how long people tank if they're facing, you know, maybe an open and a three bet in front of them. If they tank for a while, maybe they're thinking about whether or not to go for it with an ace blocker type hand. Of course, they could also be thinking whether or not to go for it with like suited connectors or, you know, the 7-4 off, because they think that this guy can't be, you know, three betting the top of his range or whatever they're thinking. That's, I think, much more. Just thinking about folded hands is definitely something I do almost always in live poker and almost never in online poker.
Yeah, I think it's a useful thing to think about. And TJ Cloutier, there's a man who believes in bunching. Or at least he did when I was playing against him the one time at the World Series. He really talks about it a lot. And he also thinks that if nines are coming on the flop, that they're more likely to come on the flop in subsequent hands. So this is...
Yeah, I think in the second World Series poker... World Series tournament I ever played, I busted Phil Hellmuth and got busted by TJ Cloutier, I think, in all within two levels. So I was really going for it back then in 2006, let me tell you.
Yeah.
Just getting Jackson free for heaps against Phil Hellmuth.
Yeah, yeah.
He had ace-king and managed to wait till he was actually at the rail to berate me.
What was that
very,
like?
Very big of him, I know.
Well, before we get into some strategy that might actually be useful to people, would you guys be interested in talking a bit about this security stuff that, I mean, people have talked about, like having their stuff stolen out of their rooms at the Rio. I think there's been some talk about like concern of stuff happening in the parking lot as well. Are you guys up for discussing that?
Yeah, sure.
Absolutely. I will start out by saying that it's very good to take these stories with a skeptical ear and not just jump to conclusions about everything you read or hear. When you kind of think about the story that of this Rio mugging, which to recap, I believe an onlooker, somebody who happened to be in the parking lot, managed to find a European person who was bloodied up and claimed that he had been confronted by two people, hit with some sort of gun, maybe pistol whipped or something. Then he was instantly knocked out, was dragged into a car, and then awoke to find himself being robbed in the car. He then kicked out the window, and then you should hear some red flags going off. And then another red flag is that he waits when he wants to avoid security. I mean, it seems like something very shady was going on. And I mean, I've read about this, and it from what I've heard, or from what the WSOP has said, it turned out to be some sort of drug deal gone bad. And I tend to believe that based on kind of the just incredibly odd details of this story. Instead of just a random mugging, because you'd think of like with a random mugging, the criminals would not drag this person to their car. They would just mug him, take the money, leave him there, run the hell away. That's like a criminal behavior. So I'm kind of inclined to believe the WSOP's quote unquote official story as to what happened. And in my experience with the World Series of Poker, I've never once really felt unsafe walking around the parking lot. And not to sound like a shill or anything, and I'm sure shady things happen and dangerous people are lurking in parking lots, and you should always be vigilant. I don't think that this is that big a deal. And sorry for the ramble, but...
No, I agree with you. I certainly agree with you with regard to that particular incident. I do think it's good I think people do need to exercise like some common sense safety stuff in the Rio parking lot. Like if I were a criminal in Las Vegas looking either to break into cars or to rob people, I'm sure the Rio parking lot is the best place to be doing that this month.
I'm not so sure.
Really?
I feel like there are probably many other security, high security risk places just in Las Vegas in general, in parking garages in general, where there either are places where the cameras aren't at. And if somebody were to research this, I mean, this would have to be one hell of an enterprising criminal. Mm-hmm. And I feel like people who are in the violent mugging game aren't exactly this enterprising in casing their victims or their locations. But there are so many dark corners that you should just kind of know to avoid.
I mean, the lines of sight.
I don't want to you know, step over into victim blaming or anything, but I just think that there's so much money, people walking around with money and chips, cash, whatever, in Vegas in general, that singling out the Rio just because the World Series of Poker is there, it just doesn't seem all that fair.
Yeah, I think that's right. And also the sight lines are pretty good in the Rio parking lot. Like, thinking about it from a criminal perspective, I'd almost rather go to the Venetian parking lot if I were looking to stick somebody up. Or as Leo said, maybe do actual research. But I wouldn't leave a $100 chip, you know, sitting on the driver's seat or something in my car. I would expect to get a window smashed fairly often in that case. But as far as parking lots go, there's a lot of lighting. It's usually pretty well trafficked, even late at night, and the sight lines are good. So, I mean, while you do have to be vigilant, and I think that's a good lesson to take, I'm not sure the Rio parking lot isn't even better than a lot of other places.
Yeah, I don't know. It'd be one thing if there were actually data about this, but is there?
Not that I know of.
Might have to check the Metro website to see if they have any sort of crime data about casino parking lots.
Yeah, it's but I mean, Andrew's point is taken, that it's a good reminder to be careful, especially when all you have to do is be at the like median of carelessness, and the criminals will go after the people more careless than you. And that's just not that hard at the World Series. So come on, strive for at least median carelessness. As for myself, I try not to keep too much money on me or in my room or like not in a box somewhere. I often take the expert strategy of storing my money in my opponent's pockets after a game. So that's, I don't know. What would you recommend, Andrew?
I think in terms of the parking lot stuff, I think it's all pretty common sense. Just like, ideally don't leave stuff in your car at all. Certainly don't leave stuff sitting out. And that includes other things that thieves like to steal. So like any sort of electronics that are appealing looking, even if they're not actually worth that much money, like having to deal with your windshield getting smashed in is still a pain. Even if the thing that they end up stealing is only worth $10 or something, it's still a pain. So like having a GPS sitting out, having an iPad or an iPhone or any sort of phone sitting out, like anything that looks appealing, I think you're better off not leaving the car at all, and certainly not leaving sitting out. I think leaving valuables in your car at all is a pretty bad idea. I'm always like conscious of my surroundings when I'm walking through the parking lot, but I've also never, I've never like seen a person who made me feel uncomfortable. I've never like gotten the sense that anyone was following me. I've never had any like remotely bad incident in the Rio parking lot myself. And, I agree with Leo's point about needing to be skeptical about some of those. The other thing where it might not be as much common sense, cause I actually was maybe a little off on this on some of the conversations I was having about it on Skype, is a lot of people have reported having stuff stolen from their rooms. Like, you know, they leave things in their room, and then when they come back, those things are no longer there. And although I do think that it's, I'm pretty comfortable with victim blaming when it comes to leaving a large amount of cash in your, like in your bag or anywhere unsecured in your room. I think it obviously it shouldn't get stolen, but realistically, I don't think you can expect it to be secure if you're leaving it in any hotel room, certainly a Las Vegas
hotel room on Secured. What I might be off is about whether leaving it in the room safe is really that much better.
You and I disagreed on this. You thought that using a safe is a good idea. I thought it was a bad idea.
I would argue that it's better than leaving it in your bag. I might not go so far as good enough.
Yeah. Okay. Well, on Twitter you said people use your room safe or something.
Yeah. No. That's what I mean. I've since been argued down from that position.
I see. Yeah. Leo, do you have thoughts on hotel room safes?
I have very mixed thoughts about hotel room safes. Because I think it really depends on from whom you're trying to secure your belongings. If you're trying to secure them from, say, hotel employees generally, there is probably a hotel employee who can access that safe. I mean, I've had the batteries die in those safes before, and they just bring up a guy who can open it willy-nilly. And what's to stop that guy, you know, if he wanted to, from rifling through your safe if you weren't there? I can't really think of anything. But on the other hand, keeping a large amount of cash in a backpack or just out in the open or in a drawer somewhere is an obvious target of opportunity for a whole different subset of hotel employees and, you know, other people who might happen to be in your room. You know, if you're upstairs hanging out on dinner break in your room and you have eight people there, you know, they're one of those eight people might be dishonest enough to take something. So it really depends. I think I generally just put it in the hotel safe because then at least I know where my stuff is. So at least it's in a place where I don't have to say, oh my God, is it in this pocket? Is it in this pocket? Did I put it under the bed? Did I, you know, put it in this drawer? If I just know it's in one place, it's safe for myself at least.
Yeah. And I guess as a local, do you just have a box or do you just use your pockets?
It depends on the amount of cash. I won't go into exact numbers, but I also have a bank account and can easily just get cash from the bank as long as it's not a Sunday. Yeah. And as long as I wake up in time to go, it's really not that tough.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we're on the same page here. Like, without going into details in either case, like neither one of us is probably carrying a ton of money and it's not that hard to say wire money to the Rio ahead of time instead of carrying 15K on the plane with you or whatever. So.
Oh yeah. Though to be fair, I have done essentially that and I've never really felt unsafe carrying large amounts of cash on a plane. And that's usually because it's in a carry-on. It's never like more than 2 feet away from my arms. So
yeah. My biggest worry there is that I'm going to leave it somewhere. Like I'm somewhat more forgetful than I would like to, if I were carrying a large amount of cash, to not have it actually on my person.
There's something about carrying that cash that, that cures me of my forgetfulness a large percent of the time.
Yeah. It does feel good to land in Las Vegas with money in your pocket.
Oh yeah, especially if you get here on, you know, say 11 p.m. on Saturday, and you just want to go hop into a cash game, it's great.
Yeah, yeah, well, it's a good feeling.
To all the thieves listening right now, I will not be arriving in Las Vegas with cash this year.
Yeah, I was thinking about tweeting that too, or something similar. Like, but
yeah. I think
I would have tweeted it would have been in very bad taste. So
I'm doing a cashier's check, and then once I pick up the money, I'm going straight to the cage to buy into the main event. So you will not catch me carrying cash around Las Vegas.
Yeah, I just wire money ahead.
You do a wire, not a cashier's check?
Yeah, because the fees are comparable and it's much easier.
Really? I get my cashier's checks for free.
You're a better man than I am, Andrew.
Wow. Nick Cast pro tips here.
Yeah. How much do you pay for a cashier's check, Leo?
Geez, the last time I got one, I think I got it for free. So yeah.
Well, maybe I should look into this then.
Yeah, Bank of America doesn't for free for me. And I mean, I have like, I don't have a huge balance on there, like maybe low to mid five figures.
Keep bragging.
All right. Cashier's check it is then.
We better get out of this bag before we get in trouble.
For more tournament poker strategy, check out Tournament Poker Edge. You'll find videos, hundreds of hours of videos, in fact, from a wide variety of professionals playing a wide variety of stakes, from the micro stakes to the high stakes, online tournaments, live tournaments, US-facing sites, European sites, and everything in between. Your source for tournament poker strategy is Tournament Poker Edge, and you can sign up at tournamentpokeredge.com. Take it away, Leo.
All right. So, I've probably gone off on similar tangents before in my life, but I often feel that my poker game is far too intuition-based and that my quote-unquote thought process is actually just a post hoc rationalization of decisions that are made, you know, entirely by my subconscious or my emotions or by something other than, you know, some logical, coherent narrative thought process that you would think a good poker player might have.
But made by System A, possibly?
System A, or, oh, I've actually read a book by Jonathan Haidt entitled The Righteous Mind, and he uses another analogy about the mind called the elephant and the rider, and the elephant is more like Kahneman's System A or System 1, whereas the rider is the rational, and the rational conscious mind, or maybe conscious is not the right word, but the rational strategic mind, let's say. And whereas the elephant is just so massive that the rider can really only hope to control it in a non-absolute way. It can nudge the elephant, it can kind of try to convince the elephant, but the elephant can, at the end of the day, do what it damn well pleases. And sometimes I feel like my poker game is much in the same way. Now, granted, the elephant has been trained by playing millions of hands and hopefully improving over the course of those millions of hands, but it's still not the same as having the rider make the decisions. Y'all feel me?
Absolutely.
So what have you been doing to put the rider in control?
That's not nearly enough. I often feel like, you know, sometimes I'm still a bit too button clicky, and I think this hand is a good example of button clicky FPS. So this is early in day two of the $1,500 six max. We're already in the money, and I started the day with about 20 something big blinds. I want to flip to get up to 40, and so I have about 40 big blinds, or say 48k at 600, 1200, 200. It folds to me in the small blind, and I look down at the jack and the nine of diamonds. The big blind has about 24k or 20 big blinds, and I decide to limp. What do you guys think of this?
Anything you can say about the big blind?
I actually cannot say much about him, except he's about my age, i.e. mid-30s, or, geez, early 30s. I apparently forgot my own age there for a second. And he looks competent, but he's been moved to the table within the last orbit, so I can't make any sort of judgment.
Yeah, so limping a lot of hands against certain player types, I think makes sense. Against the very toughest opponents, well, I'm not sure what I would do against the toughest opponents. I think jamming will be unexploitable with the ante, but that's not what I would do. 20 big blinds is a little bit deep. I think against a lot of people, I would be comfortable raise folding this particular hand. I think folding jack nine before the flop is unfortunate, but not a disaster in this case. Like, not a total, like, Hindenburg style disaster in this case. So
too soon. Too soon.
Oh,
oh, the humanity.
Right. So I would probably default to raising. But, you're going to flop pairs that you wouldn't mind having that will play well in lower SPR pots, I think. And Jack Nine's a good hand, and why not raise with it? That's not terribly sophisticated. I mean, there are a lot of there are a lot of player types that I like to limp a lot of hands against, limp jamming some of them, limp calling others, and limp folding yet others. Andrew, what do you think?
One thing that would matter to me with regard to raising is whether I think the guy will ever fold to a small raise. I think that opening for, I usually prefer opening for a larger amount from the small blind, like three times the big blind, even four times if we're deep. And here I think that makes it very enticing for him to shove a pretty wide range. And as you say, Nate, it's not a very happy feeling to raise full jack nine suited when you know you're going to have pretty decent equity against his shoving range. Not enough to call, but so I would argue that facing like a min raise or a 2.2x raise from the small blind, the big blind should literally never fold anything. Like there are some hands that you can shove and everything else you have enough equity to call. But there are big blinds who will fold hands in that case. So if you can give yourself a chance of winning the pot pre-flop, even if it's only like a 10 to 15% chance, and also not get jammed on too often, I would find that pretty appealing against a player who I think is literally never going to fold to a small raise, which is what I think, which is what I think the big blind strategy should be. Then I think limping has a lot more appeal.
Interesting. I also might be misremembering the size. He might have had a little bit more, maybe in the range of 27K, but still somewhere between 19 and, say, 23 big blinds. I think at the moment I decided to limp just because, for the reasons that Andrew stated, that I felt like I wasn't going to get many preflop folds, and I was going to get jammed on a lot and just have to fold a very, you know, a pretty strong hand. But on the other hand, I think he often defends by just calling and not by just straight ripping it in my face. So, and it probably makes it a bit easier to play post-flop when that happens. But I'm the same, again, on the other hand, if it's going to be a tough situation post-flop, I might as well keep the pot small.
What are you going to do if he raises?
It depends on the size of the raise. I think against probably at 3x, I might be inclined to maybe just shove, because I think his raises, I think, are going to be pretty... I mean, it's tough to have a great hand, obviously, but I think it's also... I'm just going to get a lot of folds in that spot, because he should be raising it somewhat wide. But if it's a smaller raise, I might just flat and see what happens. If he, you know, min raised or something, I would probably just call.
Yeah, that sounds right to me.
One extremely rough rule I have, that with a lot of exceptions, is that if I could have moved all in unexploitably at some earlier time on the street, then it's a little bit difficult to make me fold on that street.
Right.
So like limp shoving, I think, is fine. And in general, any plan that involves folding is a bit suspect, and it's hard to feel bad about shoving later on in the street when that street is pre-flop, when you could have just shoved unexploitably in the first place.
Yeah, I am inclined to agree.
All right, so you limp. What happens? Oh, sorry, dude.
No. I was gonna move things along as well.
All right, so I'll third this notion and say that the flop was King Jack Six after he checked behind fairly quickly. So King Jack Six rainbow flop, one diamond. I start with a check. What do you all think about leading here?
I like checking. It sounds like, especially with the also having a backdoor flush draw, you really don't have a lot to lose from giving a free card. I doubt he has very many aces in his range, so you're not that worried about an ace peeling off. And I mean, you definitely can get called by less good hands than yours, but I think he's a lot more likely to bluff than he is to call a bet.
One consideration in favor of betting is that you would like that your range figures to maybe be a little bit stronger once the flop comes down, because he should raise some of his kings and his jacks, and you would, I think, limp with, you know, maybe like king four offsuit or a hand like that, and then jacks such as the hand you have. So your range might be a little bit ahead of his, and you do actually have a pretty good hand, and you can expect to get value from worse hands, I think. at the end of the day, I think I might check here, but I do think there's an argument for betting.
Yeah, I think if you bet called, you get into a lot of uncomfortable spots on future streets. I don't really have a hand that I want to bet multiple times, but I think if you bet and then, I don't know, the turn is a queen, the turn is, I guess an eight's not so bad. Maybe it's just a queen that's really that bad, but I feel like if you bet and then start checking and calling, you're giving away more information about your hand than if you just start off by checking.
Yeah, I agree that this hand isn't one that we love the thought of inflating the pot with. That said, I would love to have a betting range here, right? Because I'm going to have nothing fairly often, and my range is pretty good. So when those are the case, I would like to have some aggression. So which hands am I going to do that with? Like, well, some kings, yeah, but a lot of my kings raise before the flop, so you got to put some jacks in there, I think, right?
Yeah, fair enough. I guess I'm thinking a little exploitively, but you're right that you ought to be bluffing the flop a lot, which is an argument for making a not even really that thin value bet with a jack. I do think in a vacuum it's probably more profitable to check a jack, but I think in terms of trying to have a balanced betting range, you're right that jacks are
to be fair, if I'm limping a hand as strong as Jack 9 suited instead of raising it, I'm probably also going to have a decent number of kings in my limping range. So if I want to construct kind of a value betting range, or a betting range, I think I have enough kings in that range to beef it up without really having to put a lot of jacks in there.
Good. Good. That makes sense. That makes sense. And after all, I have a cold, so I'm like 31% stupider than I usually would be. So I'll defer to you guys here.
Still, that's probably like at least an order of magnitude smarter than me on my best day. So
you're far too kind. That really can't be true. But go ahead.
Oh, okay. Order of magnitude might be maybe a standard deviation instead.
You're very kind. Well, so you check, and what happens?
He checks back pretty quickly. The turn is the Queen of Diamonds, and now I decide to check again. Not really sure really what to do on this turn, actually. I kind of debated between leading and checking and decided on a check. What do you guys think of that, first of all?
This strikes me as like the single best checking card in the deck.
Yeah, I think you're going to induce a lot of bluffs. I also think that against like a quick checking range, I don't know, I think a quick checking range might have some queens in it. So you will be behind sometimes. I wouldn't worry about being behind, but your hand is very good. You don't fear a free card really at all, or very little. And you should induce bluffs from worse hands, possibly also value bets from worse hands. What's the bottom card? A four? I think a four might bet for protection. Okay, I think a six might bet for protection here. And I mean, it might have bet the flop too, but a quick checking range is sometimes not the worst kind of hand. So yeah, I think I'd like a check here.
I think at the time, and this might be one of those post hoc rationalizations, that I checked because I might basically to induce from, say, just 10x or really just 10x, maybe 9x. That's just taking a stab now because they have no showdown value, but they have a hand that's kind of worth semi-bluffing with.
Makes sense. I mean, it's a very appealing spot, right? Like, put yourself in the other guy's shoes with 9 deuce. I would think about betting.
Oh, yeah. And he also, you know, when I check twice, I just really don't look a lot like I'm continuing.
Yeah.
And, like, I mean, king, queen, jack, five, there's not that many second best hands that are calling a bet. I know like after the flop checks through, he may subtract some kings from your range, but like you could have hit the queen on the turn. And it's not that easy for him to have a jack with in many situations where he's a jack with the worst kicker, the kicker won't end up playing. He can call you with some draws, but he'll also probably bet those. So
yeah, it depends a fair amount, I think, on exactly what the stack depth is before the flop. It depends how many aces are in his range, really. So if it's more like 27 big blinds, then I think he would often check with a hand like ace three offsuit. If you're talking more like 21 big blinds, then I think a lot of the modern players will just rip it before the flop. And I do think that you'll get a call from ace high here sometimes on the turn, thinking that they have a gut shot and also thinking that you don't have anything a lot of the time. I'm not saying it's a good play, but you know, it's you think the other guy doesn't have anything, you have an overcard and a gut shot, and it's a blind battle, and you'll feel really good about yourself if you call and you're right with an ace. So I think right. The stack size matters, but I also sort of generally affirm Andrew's point that it's not so easy to get value here.
Okay. So, that sounds good to me. So anyway, after I check, he bets 1600 into 3600. And, at this point I decide to call. I'm just not sure what better hands are folding to a raise and what worse ones are calling. So
yeah, I definitely wouldn't raise. Yep. Well, no, maybe it's okay. Not definite, but glad we're all I like calling.
Yeah. I mean, it depends a little bit. Like, I mean, against an unknown, probably not. I think some people will be very, like, six heavy here. So I mean, you're not representing much is the big problem. But I do think sometimes he'll have a hand weak enough to run off. So anyway, yeah, I would just call though.
Okay. I think that's fairly straightforward call.
Yeah.
River pairs the bottom card is a black six. So flush draw misses, and now there is a pair on board. I check again, and he now bets. I think checking here is kind of standard, and I'm not sure leading merits a whole lot of discussion. What do you guys think?
I actually didn't hear you say what the river card was.
Yeah, oh, I'm sorry. It's a black six.
Okay, so the final board is king, queen, jack, six, six.
That's right.
It's tough.
At the time, I didn't even think about leading, and that might be a leak of mine to just kind of auto-check this.
Yeah, it's hard.
I couldn't really think of any rivers I really wanted to lead here, so
yeah,
this would be a river. And thus yeah. I did not leave.
and I mean, maybe he should make some tight folds if you lead, but it's hard to see you getting value from too much or him folding too much better. I think you can represent a six here or a king, right? But what good's that going to do you? Is he really going to fold? Does he have a lot of hands between those hands and your hand? that don't beat those hands, but do beat your hand. Oh yeah, so between. I would check here. And then when he bets, you're in a tough spot. I think.
Okay,
I would,
so let's.
Did you raise? Raising might be cool.
So I check and he bets 4,500 into 6,800, and he leaves himself with about 16K behind. And I don't think calling is really an option here. And that leaves folding and ripping it in.
Good.
What do you guys
think? I like not calling. I like not reflexively calling with a pair because it's a blind battle. I think that's straightforward for you. I think it is not straightforward for all of our listeners. And a pair of jacks is a good hand.
I'll try and speak a little bit more on why I kind of immediately eliminated calling. And that's because when he bets turn, I think his range is either just pure air balls, which have not gotten there on the river, and he still has air on the river if he got there, if he got to this point in the hand with it. And the other part of his range is hands that beat me, kings, sixes. Can't really think of any queens that he's doing this with, because I suspect those check back the turn, but yeah, a lot of kings.
Really? I don't see why a queen would check the turn.
Okay. That's a good point.
I feel like queen 10, I could see myself playing it exactly this way.
Okay. Well, but still, the point remains that if he has a queen and now he's trying to get two streets, I'm still losing.
Yeah,
that
no,
well,
I mean, so. I agree. It makes a call potentially less good. But I don't know that I would rule a queen out. I think he has a pretty good, like, a queen with a decent kicker is pretty likely to be ahead here.
Okay. Though to be fair, I think most queens with these and kickers are also raising
pre.
Yeah,
that's fair.
Yeah, that's my problem. But then again, queens with bad kickers are also pretty likely to be ahead here, I think. So, less likely.
And
but.
Also, the kicker's not going to play. Actually, yeah. Come to think of it, even right. Queen 10, the kicker doesn't
good
play.
Good point.
So. Yeah. So I'll spare the spoiler alert, and I ripped it in there. And I felt like I had a lot of heart. And I also felt like his range was pretty capped at a king. And because I just did not think he'd be betting a six on the turn. And I think you guys disagree with that notion, actually.
I'm actually more surprised so at the time, to I see kind him of check figured, a six on the flop. I think that's more surprising. That, like, if I did check a six on the flop, there's a decent chance I'd bet the turn with it. But I don't know why I would check it on the flop.
Right, so at the time I kind of figured that if he has a six, it's probably queen six exactly, because now that makes perfect sense that he'd check it back. If he checked it back on the flop, then he would obviously bet his two pair and then his boat. But then I also just figured if his range is mostly capped at a king, it's going to be really tough for him to call off his tournament life with just that, or especially also with a queen, when I could very much represent a six here. I think my range actually has at least as many sixes as his when we get to this point.
Let's talk for a second about why you're ruling out calling. Because, I mean, what you said is that you think his range is going to be polarized to, like, air or, you know, either kings plus or maybe queens plus. I don't think that makes a jack an obvious fold. I mean, it's a bluff catcher against that range, like many other hands are. What's your reason for taking calling off the table entirely?
I thought my reasoning also, I mean, that's a good point in that I think he might have enough bluffs in his range, but a lot of those bluffs I kind of have blockers to. The nine of diamonds being a card that would often be in his hand if he's bluffing, because he would have a flush draw that missed or a straight draw that missed, whether that's 9x or 10x. And also, that's actually really the main reason.
So, I mean, what do you think happened?
I just did not think there were a lot of,
I mean, let's say that he has kind of misdraws, seven deuce offsuit. What do you think he would do with that? Like, why couldn't he play seven deuce this way?
That's an excellent question. He very may well play seven deuce this way, and if he's playing all of his air hands this way, then calling probably does become better than check raising or check folding.
I mean, I wouldn't say that you should not have a calling range here at all, or that like you should never call here with a pure bluff catcher. I do think that a jack is pretty much the bottom of your range after taking this line. Like, if you had a draw of your own, like, that didn't have any showdown value, I think that you would have bet either the flop or the turn rather than checking and calling. And now that the six has paired, because that six is another hand that you might be checking and calling, and now that that's paired, I do think that a jack is the bottom of your range, which is an argument for turning it into a bluff as opposed to bluff catching with it. But it's not obvious to me why we wouldn't call with any kind of pure bluff catcher.
No, I think you're right about this, and perhaps at the time I thought maybe my calling range had enough kings and queens in it to just to beef it up enough to prevent the need from calling with just a pure bluff catcher, but that could be way off base.
Yeah, I don't know that I'd check a lot of kings on the turn. Queens I could see, though, and my queen is certainly a better calling hand than a jack, because I do think it's possible for him to bet queens on the river. So I think that might be an argument I'm more ready to accept, that you should call with your queens and shove with your jacks and your sixes.
I'd agree with that. So spoiler alert, I guess, he tanked and then eventually called with the king and the five, which is a very good call, and not the kind of call I expect an unknown opponent to make very often at the World Series of Poker, because it is one of those hands that is really toward the top of his range for getting to that spot, and so he probably should not be folding it. And, you know, against my actual hand, he played it absolutely perfectly. But it's not that strong in an absolute sense. So I think some of the more level one thinkers or absolute hand strength type thinkers would just kind of fold or see the six pair and say, I know you got there, or something like that. And so I guess on one hand, it's an okay bluff in that it was the bottom of my range. I have to have a bluffing range to balance out the time when I actually do have a six in this spot, et cetera, et cetera. But on the other hand, it might not have been so good because it was just against the wrong opponent type. And of course, how could I have known that before?
Yeah, I mean, there's some chance that he just said, like, top pair, blind battle, call. I mean, I know he didn't snap call, but still.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, he told me he almost folded, and I was like, well, that's what I was trying. That's what I was going for, so nice call.
Okay, well, yeah, nice end. Yeah. I think you played it well.
Yeah, I like your play. I like your play. And it's tough, like, sort of choosing a framework in which to make your decisions. Like, yeah, it's possible this was the wrong opponent type, but I think you played your hand in a fundamentally sound way. Maybe not perfect, but maybe perfect. And, yeah, good hand. On to the next one.
Yeah, that was definitely one where I felt better about going for it and losing than I normally do. If that makes sense.
Good.
So, let's see. On to the next hand. So this is from a bit deeper in the 3K 6-max. And I believe the table was playing five-handed at this point, but I'm not 100% certain. So, to start out, a guy who seemed pretty good, like pretty much the entire table. He was a little loose with his defending, but I didn't think he was opening particularly wide. He opens to 6K at 1.5K, 3K with a 400 ante, and he opens from the cutoff, either the cutoff or the hijack. It depends on whether or not it's six or five handed, which my memory is failing me at the moment. But anyway, he had a bit over 200K, or like 66 or so big blinds, and I cover him by about 30K. I think I started the hand with about 230K. I'm in the small blind, and I look down at two blackjacks, and I decide to 3-bet them. So first of all, what do you guys think about calling versus 3-betting? I know this is most of the time going to be a 3-bet, and I think your 3-betting range generally include jacks in this spot. But maybe there are some tournament-specific considerations or opponent-specific considerations that might sway your decision. What do y'all think?
I am really not a big fan of flatting out of the small blind. I think that this is a little more true in cash games than it is in tournaments, because antes, I mean, sometimes you are getting some pretty good odds in the small blind to call with some hands that you would fold in a cash game. But I think that if you never flatted out of the small blind, I don't think you would do a lot worse than if you did have a small blind calling range.
Yeah, that ties into something I was going to say, which is that my biggest reason, hypothetically, for wanting to call jacks would be really wanting to have a calling range, which often I wouldn't. But if this was the sort of opponent who I thought maybe I'd have good control over after the flop, who I thought maybe played re-raised pots really well or would 4-bet me way too much or something, then you know, you can imagine various reasons for wanting to call out of the small blind a fair bit. And if you're going to call out of the small blind, you might be doing it with hands like sixes and sevens, and maybe you'd like to have jacks also in that range. Then, you know, 3-bet queens are better, and then some unpaired high card hands, and then some other stuff too. So I would think of it like the other way, not so much what do I want to do with jacks, but like, do I want to have a calling range? Or a big calling range or a small calling range if I do. So usually the answer is going to be no, I don't want to be calling much or at all, and I like 3-betting with the jacks. Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes sense to me. I think, I mean, I would need a lot of a lot of incentive to do other than three betting. Like, say, I thought that the big blind was going to spaz out if I flatted, and I could induce that way, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or, I mean, there would have to be some sort of kind of big ICM considerations, and we're definitely not close enough to the final table or any big payout jumps for me to really feel that way.
Yeah. Good.
So I 3-bet it to 17K, a little less than 3X, and he calls fairly quickly.
Okay.
The flop is 9-8 blank. I don't remember the third card. I think let's just call it a 4. Rainbow. I decided to c-bet, and I bet 23K into the 39K or so out there in the pot.
You said his stack is about 200K? Okay.
That's right.
Sounds good.
And he calls pretty quickly. The turn is the 10 of spades putting a spade draw out there. And here is where I think a lot of options become extremely viable and probably extremely close. What do y'all think about checking versus betting here?
That's really interesting. That's really interesting. I think I would lean toward betting. I think I would be betting a lot of hands worse than this. I think getting it in with this hand might be uncomfortable. You might be behind fairly often, but it's not going to be terrible. And depending on the opponent, you could be really happy to get it in here also. You can also represent or even have hands that just don't want to give up, like ace-jack or a hand like that, king-jack. Yeah. I mean, then depending on how light your 3-betting range is, you can have other stuff too. Other weaker hands also. I think this card hits his range pretty well, but I'm not sure well enough that you need to get into defensive mode against it. Like, I wouldn't want to check fold this card, certainly. And betting opens up the possibility of a raise. I'm not sure how bad that is, because after all, you do have to play the river. So I mean, stacks are in play already. So I think, boy, yeah, I think I would bet and be pretty happy about it. What do you think, Andrew?
I agree that you don't want to be in a defensive mode here. So I would rule out check folding, and I would rule out check calling. So yeah, I'm choosing between bet calling. I don't think I'm not going to bet fold. So I guess I'm choosing between bet calling, check shoving, or I could maybe see a case for just shipping it. So I guess that'd be about 2x pot.
Yeah, that'd be a pretty big overbet. Let's see, 46 plus 39. That's like about 85. So yeah, that'd be a little less than 2x pot.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that would be maybe a plausible way of playing some hands like ace-jack or two spades with a gut shot and an overcard. I feel like you could maybe just have a shoving range rather than a bet folding range and a bet calling range. I can't think of too many hands that I would barrel on the turn that I'd be real unhappy about forcing myself to shove instead.
Interesting. The comments about defensive mode kind of struck me as interesting, because I feel like I almost did go into defensive mode a bit, and perhaps this is more evidence for my groundbreaking thesis of emotions and intuition. I'm totally in control of my poker game rather than logic. But when that 10 of spades comes, geez, my first thought is, oh my god, is he slow playing a set, and does he now have the one over pair that I beat? I'm now losing to, oh my god, oh my god, oh my god. And I remember, actually, I feel like I'm in good company with this thought process, because I remember reading Phil Galfond once saying, maybe in his 2+2 well, that he has this same kind of pessimistic outlook where, you know, if he has top pair, top kicker, and then, you know, if he has ace king on ace 10 3, and then the jack hits, he's like, oh my god, does he have ace jack? Does he have king queen? And so that's kind of the thought process that spurred me to check it to him and then make a decision based on what he did.
So that's really interesting. I think so. In say the cash games I play, I think I would be thinking that way. Because I think I would expect people to have tighter calling ranges before the flop. But against the player you describe, I think, like, what do you think he's doing before the flop with the queen nine suited?
Probably calling.
Okay.
I'd imagine. But also the same goes for, say, 10-9 suited, 10-8 suited, which now also make two pair.
It's true. It's true. But then, you know, there's jack nine and 9-7 and 8-7 and 8-6. And,
oh, yeah. I have two big blockers to jack nine, though.
That's yeah, that's right.
That I have two blockers to a lot of the pair plus draw combos that he might
have. Yeah, I was going to say queen 10, queen jack, jack 10, but I guess you're blocking a number of those as well.
Yeah. And then there's ace 9, you know, a lot of... Yeah, it's just... Boy, it's hard to beat an overpair. Maybe it's not that hard, but... sorry to go into, like, 1999 mode on you, but... I mean... Like I said, I think when the money gets in here, you're going to be behind pretty often, but not often enough to get defensive, I think. But, you know, maybe this gets back to the blockers discussion that we had until now mercifully left in the past, or sorry, the bunching discussion. But maybe this is something that we should be answering with a computer and not with our intuition.
that's a good idea. Let's train those computers, those computer whips.
Yeah, it's I mean, I like my elephant, but maybe it shouldn't be making the call here. It's like something that's like a fairly straightforward question, I think.
That's a good point. Another kind of a live pokery type detail that I omitted earlier was that before I checked, I asked him how much he had back, and he just kind of showed it, and I think he might have said about 150K. Okay. I don't know if that really changes the analysis much or how much you want to, you know, dive into the rabbit hole of live poker soul read mindfuckery, but what do you guys think of that?
Boy, that's interesting. I think sometimes that's taken as an attempt to intimidate. I think in this particular case I wouldn't make too much of it. I think probably you both consider the other good players, and this is a case where stack sizes really do matter a lot. I think you would care about his exact stack size with plenty of hands here. Yeah, I wouldn't make too much of it. You know, a certain kind of opponent might be a little more likely to try to take you off your hand after you ask that, but I wouldn't think too much of it. Andrew?
I don't think I have a strong opinion on that.
All right. So, I check and he quickly bets, I think it was about 26K into the 85K in the pot. And I guess my decisions now are between calling and making a raise of some sort and some size.
That's pretty interesting, because now with that small bet size, raising feels awkward and I might just call. but boy, I just said I didn't want to be defensive.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you regarding the small bet size.
with the small bet size, like, my first thought was to call, but then I kind of thought about it a little more, and it just seemed like I set myself up to make some pretty big river mistakes if I just check call.
Right.
And so to avoid that, I just checked and ripped it.
Yeah, I like after thinking about it, I think I like that better. Like, he's equally aware that size is awkward to raise over, and again, getting back in sort of in spirit to something I said earlier, like, if your plan was to put the chips in at the beginning of the street, which mine was, the fact that, yeah, I'm not sure I would let a small bet size discourage me from it. I would probably get uncomfortable and then raise call or just rip it anyway.
I think, I was thinking something and then it kind of just popped right out of my head. So please save me.
but it's an interesting situation. I think it's worth thinking about why he might bet small. Draws turned, various kinds of draws turned, including pair hands that now have a gutter in silly things like this, or pair hands that now have an open ender, even though you block some of those. Maybe he is betting this much to try, because he would like you to fold, but also he doesn't want you to raise. and he thinks that that bet can accomplish it, that would be another reason for you to raise. That said, I wouldn't put too much stock in this kind of reasoning just because it's a tournament, and that kind of bet can get a lot of work done, and bet sizes skew smaller anyway. So.
Okay. So the thought has come back, and that thought is that I'm not sure that he thinks I would play sets plus this way, because it's such a wet board, and having a four straight or a three flush come on the river for my set is somewhat of a disaster. So I think one problem with my line is that it kind of looks a lot like what it is, jacks, jack 10, maybe like ace jack of spades, something like that, that might not get, well, I mean, that might work for me, and that could get a hero call from like ace 10 or something, but, yeah.
I like that point a lot. I like that point a lot. I think this relates to the first thing I said, which is that I would like to be betting on this card pretty often, and this is a pretty good hand to be betting with. I'm happy to put this hand in my betting range. I didn't have this explicitly in mind, but of course it's related, and I agree that it's going to be hard for him to put you on a hand much better than yours, or possibly much worse than yours. I like that point.
Yeah, I mean, I really think you're overestimating how strong he's going to be on the turn. Although you're right that this is a card that improves like some chunk of his range. The more I think about it, like, I don't see why he can't call the flop with pocket pairs, like all pocket pairs. I mean, I don't think it's a guarantee that he's going to fold like pocket twos at any point prior to the turn. I think he can have like ace queen or ace jack that on the flop is just like two pretty good overcards. So, you know, now not all of those, like the small pocket pairs, you're not getting any value from betting those. I do think there's a chance he might turn some of them into a bluff when you check. Like, I'd be pretty tempted if I had pocket twos to try to two barrel you here. If once you check, like, there's a lot of value in getting you to fold if you do have ace king, and if you don't have ace king when you check call the turn, I'd be pretty tempted to try to take you off of it on the river,
right? And especially if the river's an ace or a king or something, where I just don't feel very great about calling.
Yeah. Hey Andrew, would you peel deuces on this flop against Leo?
Yeah, I think I would.
All right.
Oh well. I'm thanking you for your donation, buddy.
Yeah, I would. Yeah, Leo, would you peel deuces on this flop against Andrew?
Probably not, but no, it's obviously in my four to six range. So against Andrew, come on. No, but with these stacks, I'm probably not peeling deuces. I'm probably peeling them pre because it seems like an okay spot to set mine. But I think I'm probably just not getting to showdown, not getting and not getting him to fold enough to really make it a good peel. But
that's what I thought. I mean, that's what I would do. I mean, Andrew's a smart
guy. So it's hard to see how I don't have enough equity to call you. I mean, are you just thinking that I'm going to get barreled really frequently?
Yeah, you're going to get barreled. You're going to be behind, I think, quite a bit already. And yeah, so between not realizing your equity and not having equity, both because a lot of hands have, I mean, every hand has overcards. A lot of hands have pairs that are better than yours. You have very little equity when you're behind. And a lot of random hands have like backdoor draws and things like that. I think your equity sucks and you're not going to realize all of it.
Yeah, and especially I think I'm, you know, my three betting range doesn't exactly whiff against that on that board. I mean, it's not the best board for it, but it's not like I'm not through betting, you know, 10-9 suited out of the small blind, occasionally at least. I mean, I'm probably not flatting it. So you could be behind to those types of hands, which in a three bet pot just aren't that likely to get folded. And of course, then they're just the overpairs, which I'm through betting 100% of the time, occasionally sets, but maybe those find a flat pre. Yeah, I just think that it's such a good board to barrel on, and there's so many turns that are just going to be uncallable for you that peeling deuces seems just too wide. And I don't think I'm giving up on. I think I'm going to convince myself to fire again on the turn on plenty of turn cards. At least enough to make deuces probably a losing peel.
Okay, so some other hands that I think are pretty plausible where I don't really want to give him a free card or kind of put him in control of the betting are like queen eight suited, queen nine suited, jack eight suited. I think there's a lot of hands. I mean, I guess you're blocking the jack eight, eight seven suited. I think there's a lot of hands like that where he can take a free card with a lot of value and often will. And like by checking, I think he's pretty likely to check those hands back. And he gets to realize a lot of equity when he does that. And you know, he's going to call a bet. He may even call a shove.
Yeah. So the result is that he actually folded within 10 seconds. And then he claimed that he folded queens.
Promise.
he did not have queens. There's no way. He was just straight up lying to me at the table, which, by the way, I love doing at the poker table. Just straight up lying to people about what my hand was.
Yeah, he didn't have queens.
He did not. No way. But I secretly hope he did. The hope is springing eternal. So, anyway, one another hand?
I could go either way. Andrew,
how are we doing on time? Yeah, I'm game.
This one's pretty much a shorty and probably more about the whole emotion versus logic thing than about the actual gameplay. But this is a little later in this same Six Max tournament. And my image is probably a little bit on the loose side. I had gotten caught three betting the King Nine suited against an under the gun raise and had to call it off against a cold four when I was getting 2-1 and lost a flip to eights, which of course is obviously lucky that I ran into the bottom of his range and unlucky that it didn't happen to win the flip. But I had been kind of opening up and three betting more because I had gone in a heater and increased my stack to above average. So anyway, the blinds are now 2K, 4K with a 500 ante, and it folds around to the hijack, who's kind of a middle-aged gentleman who has been playing somewhat solid and folding probably a bit too much to three bets, especially out of position. And he has about 150K and he opens to 9K, so 2.25X. That was his standard raise size. I'm next to act in the cutoff and I make it 23K. And have I told you all my hand yet?
No.
That's good, because what do you think my three betting range should consist of against a guy like this?
Seems like it should be pretty wide. I mean,
obviously,
if he folds too much, and I'm going to assume also does not play great when he does call, I'd be pretty inclined to just not have a flatting range against him. I mean, I'm going to guess he doesn't four bet that much either.
I was about to ask was if you do split your range here. And my reflexive answer is no. I'm probably not flatting very much at all here, and just three betting almost all the stuff I'm continuing with, just to kind of prevent the button from coming along for one, and because he's folding too much for another, and I can win the pot immediately, etc.
Yeah, I mean, I would guess too that he's probably not four betting optimally.
So there's certainly plenty of hands where I can very comfortably three bet fold to him,
but also like where those hands matter. So I mean, sometimes there's an argument for not three betting certain hands even against a player who folds a lot, because if that player just like strictly fold four bets, then your hand doesn't really matter, so you might be better off like flatting some hands and then just three bet bluffing just with like a hand that's not good enough to flat. But assuming this is a guy who's not going to four bet that much and fold too much, I think that's an argument for just through betting everything that you're going to play.
Okay. So another kind of live pokery detail about this hand, and one thing I'm somewhat proud of myself for doing throughout this tournament is I had looked left before three betting and thought I picked up on my opponent on the button giving off a bit of a disinterest telegraphing the fold tell, which on one hand might make me want to flat more because now I don't have to face the button. on the other hand, might as well 3-bet still.
Yeah, I mean, he might change his mind if you flat. The flatting still invites the big blind in with really good odds.
Yeah. Yeah, points for looking left, but I still like a 3-bet.
Okay. So now the button looks at his cards again and makes it 49K over my 3-bet. And he had about 150K behind.
Wow. So now I think that's a weak mean strong tell. And if this is a complicated charade, I'm happy to let him fool me. I would think that he's strong here and play accordingly. Like I would say his likeliest hand is something like ace king. And yeah.
Especially if he didn't think about it for a while.
He actually 4-bet very, very quickly, surprisingly quickly. After rechecking his hand.
Yeah, I think he's going to have exactly ace king a lot here. I think that's the likeliest story. That's not that he'll have that 100% of the time, or even that'll be strong 100% of the time, but I would tread cautiously and fold most of my 3-betting range to that 4-bet.
Yeah, I mean, I would think like if his thought process were, if you were actually disinterested, I think his thought process would need to go like, oh, I'm bored, I'm not going to play this, and I wonder if this would be a good light 4-betting spot. Like, I don't think he would just be able to snap 4-bet you if he was actually planning on folding a second before you 3-bet.
Though to be fair, he did relook at his cards before he made that decision. So something in that moment might have, made his alarm go off to go light.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I'm inclined.
And also, since I haven't talked about actual hat here, we're now getting good odds to call. We have to call 26 more to win possibly 23 plus 49 plus like 6 plus.
Yeah, I mean, I don't fold very often getting those odds, but I'd be pretty reluctant to. I wouldn't be thinking I should just jam light because it seemed like he was going to fold and now he's 4-betting. I don't think I'd like take.
So you would defend mostly by calling.
Well, here. I guess what I'm saying is that I wouldn't assume that his 4-bet is just guaranteed to be light because it seemed like he was going to fold a second ago. I might even just sort of ignore the fact that it seemed like he was going to fold. I might just kind of take that off the table in my consideration of the hand and just like jam whatever hands I would have jammed if I hadn't picked up that tail in the first place and he had just called 4-bet me.
Interesting. So, what kind of hands do you think belong in a 5-betting in a 3-to-5 range here? Besides, of course, premiums. And actually, I guess you can almost make an argument for flatting some premiums. Maybe perhaps not a very good argument because with the aces, you don't want to lose your immediate value when he's so often is cold 4-betting something that he's just going to go with. If he's light sufficiently often, perhaps flatting those premiums is better.
Yeah, I agree with all that, but I don't think he's light sufficiently often, so.
Well, and it's such a big pot at this point. There's a lot of risk involved in flatting hands that aren't aces because of the relative ease of getting a flop that ends up costing you the pot when you have those hands. And like you say, there are some drawbacks to flatting aces in that there are some flops where you don't end up stacking some hands that you'd really like to stack. But I actually think there's more of a case for flatting aces here than there is for flatting like queens or jacks.
I 100% agree there. I think if I had aces through jacks in this situation, I would have been pretty much more than happy to rip it in. As the case is in this particular hand, I did not have those. In fact, I had the 10-8 of diamonds.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty clear call.
Which, in retrospect, is a call. But actually, I was kind of so convinced that he had it at the time that I just folded.
Yeah.
Which I think is just way too nitty and pessimistic.
Yeah.
That's a
mistake I would make. we're buddies. That's great.
Pessimism buddies.
Yeah.
I wish I could high-five you through the internet, bud.
Yeah. That's.
I mean, given that having it can include ace king, that makes me pretty reluctant to fold 10-8 suited, getting better than 3-to-1.
Yeah, I think that was just far too needy. I think it was a spot where the elephant kind of broke loose. Yep.
Yeah, very good.
Live poker.
It's, yeah, very good. So, I don't know. It sounds like you're playing well. It sounds like you're playing well.
That's just because I didn't tell you the hands where I totally botched it. But those are more for when I'm sitting alone crying somewhere. They're not for public consumption.
Yeah, you're allowed to present yourself as you wish on the Thinking Poker podcast. That's okay.
Oh, yes. I'm going to unabashedly unthinking player on the Thinking Poker podcast.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I do kind of spend a lot of time thinking about how I don't think at poker. So a lot of meta thinking.
Yeah.
Last question for you, Leo.
Yeah.
Last question. Are you going to be at the Thinking Poker Nickcast meetup?
When is it?
It will be Saturday, July the 5th at 10 a.m. at the Gold Coast Bowling Alley. So that's day 1A of the main event, 10 a.m.
I haven't decided when I'm playing the main event, but day 1A sounds kind of rotten, so I think I'll probably be there. I'll try to be there. I could still be in, you know, the little one for one drop or something.
Well, the more reason to stop by, so we can wish you good luck.
Absolutely.
Very good. Well, thanks very much for coming on the show during a busy and it sounds like a emotionally difficult summer. So good for you.
it's always emotionally difficult when you're a ridiculous neurotic perfectionist. But yeah, actually today was perfect timing. And I get to take a day off today, take a day off tomorrow, see the Book of Mormon. I've only been waiting like 3 years to see that play and avoiding spoilers for 3 years. So finally, you know, I listened to all the songs from Avenue Q at some point, so I never actually ended up seeing the musical. I didn't want the same to happen with Book of Mormon. So can I go another 30 hours or negative 80 hours from the time people are actually going to hear this? to, you know, without hearing a song or spoiler, I think I'm going to make it.
Very good. Congratulations, Leo.
Thank you.
All right, enjoy, and hopefully we'll get a chance to run into you, and if you don't make it to the meetup, we should make sure we have dinner or something while we're out there.
Sounds fantastic. Good luck to both of you, and see you in Vegas.
Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Take care.
Later. Take away the pain. Sleepless nights, do I need some kind of pill? Or the devotion of a Carmelite, or the fair passage of a bill?